I came all the way out here one time, went all the way down to Philadelphia with a blank from Bob Hope, covered something like 6,000 miles.
No.
I'd never forgotten that. Left a scar on my soul.
What happened?
I never told Hope.
Well, what happened?
I just came back again. Something goofed out.
I'm going to tell him.
You dog.
Here, take this.
All right.
Here's some ice, and there's water. Now, fix your own drink, because I'm the lousiest drink mixer in the whole world.
My wife makes them too strong, too.
I make them too strong or too weak or anything. Leave this door open in case the fall.
Where's the water over here?
Son of a bitch, we sat in here yesterday and today, my writers and myself, all day yesterday this morning, and wrote practically two-thirds of a whole new show for my Shower of Stars. And we didn't like the first stuff.
Where are you going to sit? Right here.
Hold on, I'll be back.
All right.
Sat here and spent all day, but I think we got some good stuff out of it. Sometimes under pressure. Then I bring all my guys, you know.
How many fellas do you have, Jack?
Well, I only have four, really, but there are two that work on the Shower of Stars, two other guys. But they were under pressure with this because they had this show to do and didn't find out who was going to be in our cast until almost the last minute.
That's always the help, isn't it?
Yeah, that's awful. I should have known it a long time ago. And so they were in a spot, you know, and they had to write anything until we had to fix it up. So we sat there and we got pretty good results, you know.
What did they do? Walk up and down the room and think?
No. We work in a very, very funny way. It's too bad that people can't be in to watch us work sometimes, a fellow like you, for instance, Pete, because...
I'd be curious.
Well, I'll tell you, the only thing that it would do, it sometimes, when writers may know that somebody's in there, then they might feel like pressing.
Like praise up,
or they'll press. Each one thinks, oh, I ought to have a joke, or I ought to have something. In this way, you see, these fellows have been with me for years, and they know that I don't pay any attention to who gives me which joke. Because there isn't a week where each one of them doesn't come up with something great, or one week one fella might have a better idea, the next week it's somebody. And I don't try to remember because they're all good or I wouldn't have them with me in the first place, you know. And the one doesn't have to be good on Tuesday. He can be good on Wednesday, you see. And sometimes I might be the fella that comes up with the idea or the joke, you know. But we sit around. But what I'm trying to say is when we write, we have a lot of fun writing, and we, as I told you, I think the other day in the that we don't do any. There's no pressure on the writing because we don't try to have any particularly great show. You see, we merely try to have a good show, and then if it turns out fine, great. So there's no pressure, and by having no pressure, you sit down. We have a lot. We're allowed to stop writing and tell a lot of jokes. We have a girl here who does my script girl, you see. We sit around, we tell a lot of gags.
What does she do? Copy
we stop
down?
Huh?
What's the script girl do?
Oh, right? Sure. Well, she writes only when we are definitely writing on the show. But if we're thinking of jokes, she'll put down each thing we say, so in case we want to go back to it.
Forget it.
We won't forget it, you see. But we sit around, and isn't that the pressure that you see with a lot of people working with writers or writers working alone, where they just sit down and see, now we have to be here from 8 o'clock in the morning till so and so and get this much done by 12 o'clock. And I never found
this.
Start
with a situation? Start with an idea?
No, we start with an idea. Now we start with an idea.
Just for example, what did you start with yesterday?
Well, yesterday we started with. See, we had already had the sketch written. That merely had to be tightened up a little bit, you see. That we do later in the show. And we had a routine that I do with Hedy Lamarr, which was almost right, but had to be fixed up a little. I want to do the last minute editing so we don't have to change too much later. But, we wanted to write, I didn't like the opening monologue. And I said, now let's sit down and let's not put down a word till we think, how am I going to be introduced? What am I going to say when I come out? Now let's get onto a subject. Then let's get our four or five jokes that fit.
Yeah, I think I'd die if you said that to me. I'd just go blank. I wouldn't.
No, not if you have four fellas sitting with you and yourself, and you have fun, you laugh, and you have a drink, and you, if you're going to sit like this, you will. But if you don't give a damn, if you get it now or you get it 2 hours later, as long as you get it today, you're not going to, you know.
Well, what'd they come up with just for the hell of it?
Well, somebody came up with, what we used to do is, for instance, the host of that show is Bill Lundigan, you know, for the shower, climax of the Shower of Stars.
So pissed about it.
And as a rule, he introduces me with some kind of a little insulting joke, you see, and then I go in and I stop and I say, wait a minute, so and so. Now this is the thing we do once in a while. And I said, fella, just for a change now, let's throw this thing out. I don't remember now what it was. And let's just for a change, him giving me a nice introduction, you see. So I said, let him just say something plain, like, now, ladies and gentlemen, the Shower of Stars welcome you to the program, and the Chrysler Corporation takes great pleasure in introducing a man who needs no introduction, Jack Benny. And I come out, and then I talk to him, well, that was very nice of you, Bill, to give me such a nice, it's the first time you've done that in a long time. And then he tells me why, and we gradually, why he's doing that, and from that we've gotten the jokes. And finally, one of my writers says, I got a great idea, as long as you want to do that, have him say, ladies and gentlemen, a man who's been in show business so many years that he needs no introduction, and here he is, and don't mention your name. Now you walk out, but have the audience rehearse not to give you one hand. And after you stand there, the audience will naturally laugh because they're in on it. Then you see you're getting no applause with that marvelous introduction about needing no introduction. So then when I see I didn't get a hand, I merely turn to the host, Bill Lundigan. I say, Bill, I'm afraid I was wrong. Let's try it your way. So then I walk off, and then he says, ladies and gentlemen, even though he has been in show business a long time, he still needs an introduction, and here he is, Jack Benny. Then I come out, and then we went into a routine about how surprised I was. I just can't get over the fact that in all these years and everything that when you didn't mention my name, that they didn't know who I was. Now this gave us a subject. You see, now you got us, now you can go. If we want to, we can go 15 minutes with that, but we can't. We only go 2 minutes or something. But it gave us, what I'm trying to say is, it's a springboard. There's no, with my character and everything, there's no, there isn't a writer, or my even myself, who's not a writer. I'm more of a co-writer, an editor, you know? By the way, Pete, if you ever want a good co-writer sometimes, take me.
I could use one.
Yeah, take me, because I'm an awfully good editor. I may not help you much in original jokes, but boy, can I edit. And
what was that story that you started to tell me, the funny story that your friend just told you before we get
this is just a joke. Yeah, this is a joke. And then a friend just told me this. I was over at the Hillcrest Country Club. A friend of mine told me this. He said, there was a fellow who was some kind of a scientist, and he was in the business of crossbreeding animals, you see. And he went to a friend of his one day, and he says, you know, I've got an idea. I'm going to try something. I'm going to try to crossbreed. Is that correct, try to crossbreed?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to try to crossbreed a parrot and a lion. Well, gee, that'll be something. If you can do that, I said, I'm going to try it. Oh, maybe a year later. He ran into the same fellow. He says, hey, you remember that time I told you I'm going to try and crossbreed a parrot and a lion? He said, yeah. He said, well, I finally did it and got a great result. The fellow said, no kidding, what is it? He said, I don't know, but when it talks, you better listen. Isn't that a great joke? Isn't that a great joke? In fact, I wrote it down. Irving Brecker. I got to write it down so that I don't. Irving Brecker told me.
So that you know what?
I don't forget it. I want to tell some folks tonight coming over to my house.
Jack, there's two or three questions that came out of our lunch meeting the other day I wanted to ask you about before I forget about it.
Mm.
One of them has to do with Sergeant Bilko, that routine about he the wire he ended up by sending you, and how you first met him, you advised him not to go into television. Can you go through that again?
Well, you see, Phil Silvers and I have been very, very close friends for a good many years, you see. Although we don't see each other too much because he's in New York and I'm here, but this has nothing to do with friendship. Even Bob Hope, who lives here, was a very close friend of mine. I can't see him very much. But however, Phil Silvers, when he was such a big hit in that show Top Banana, and he was thinking maybe he should go into television, I was the one who was sort of sincerely advising him not to go into television. And the reason for that was, I felt that he was such a big success as a Broadway star in shows that he should go into one show after another and not be worried about television and show every week and writers and everything. And I meant it in all sincerity. I didn't know he was going to be this big. If I thought he was going to be this big, I wouldn't have advised him against it. But I did. I thought, well, maybe if he does a television show, it'll only be as good as some of the good ones. While on the stage, he can be the greatest. And he agreed with me. He said, Jack, you're right. I'm going to try just to stay on the stage. But the next year, another big Broadway show didn't come along. You know, they don't come along every minute. So he was forced to take to television, with the result that he not only found a great format, but even though both he and I were nominated for many Emmys, he won all of them. So, this struck me so funny that I was the fellow that advised him not to go into television, then he beat me by winning all the awards, that after he won the Emmys, I sent him a wire. And I said, Dear Phil, you wouldn't listen to me, would you? So, the other night, at my testimonial dinner, that was given to me, the Pryors gave one for me for the heart fund. I got a wire back from Phil, and it said, Dear Jack, if I had listened to you 3 years ago, I would have been able to attend your dinner tonight.
Then there was something wonderful. Who was it that said, there but for me go I? Was that?
No, that was Georgie Jessel.
Would you tell me about that?
Well, Jessel has always been very, very complimentary to me and about me, you know. And evidently, he thinks I'm pretty good, I'm always grateful when somebody who I think is quite as brilliant as Jessel and a man in our business thinks that, I'm very flattered.
Well,
you see?
It should be, I think, yeah.
And because we feel that people in our business are sophisticated, at least in our line of business, you see. So when somebody like Jessel likes me, I feel quite flattered. And he, in introducing me, he said a very, very nice thing. He was talking about...
Introducing you where, Jack?
At the testimonial dinner.
Same dinner.
For me, yes. He was the toastmaster, you see. He said something meaning that... he said something about that I had good taste and that I knew exactly what to do for each occasion. And he said he wishes that he always had it because every time he sees me walking down the street, he always says, well, there but for I goes me. Which was probably the finest compliment that I've ever gotten from anybody, you know?
That's a real brilliant remark.
Yes, it is. It is. And he feels that sometimes, I guess, that he gets out of line once in a while and doesn't care, you know. But he's a very brilliant toastmaster. Probably the best in America. Could be one of the best in the world.
Does he do different material for each time? Or
has
he
got he has maybe some stock things like we all have, but every dinner is different. You have different people to introduce. The guest of honor is usually different.
It always seems fresh with him.
Yes, well, it is. He makes it fresh, you know. He generally has two-thirds of it, or more than that, I would say, five-sixths of it new. And then there's some things that he might remember that he's done before now. But with each occasion, of course, you have to have new material. Like, for instance, if
if Georgie Jessel were the guest of honor and I was the Toastmaster, I couldn't say the same thing about him that I'd say about Mr. Spiro Skouras or something, you know.
You know, the other day at lunch...
Did you hear the wonderful line Jessel pulled once? He always says that he's ready for every occasion. There he is. He says, like, for instance, when I go to a funeral, he says, I'm naturally prepared for the right eulogy.
Right.
So finally, they say, well, what would you do if in the middle of your speech, for some reason or other, by some sort of phenomenon, the body sat up from the casket? He said, I'd go right into two choruses of Strutter's Ball.
But we won't. You were telling me the other day that what I thought was fascinating and interesting, that the business of what seems ad lib, it has to be worked out, it has to be planned. For example, when you and Bob Hope get together, and it seems like you're just sort of tossing each other balls out of left field, that there's really all... Would you tell me about that? You had a theory about it. It should be prepared.
Yeah, well, Pete, I'll tell you how I feel about prepared comedy and about impromptu entertainment and ad-libs. I like to ad-lib the same as everybody else. I'm maybe not as good as some people. I might be better than others. I think I can ad-lib through situations when I'm a Toastmaster. I think I can ad-lib when a speaker gets up and sits down and leaves me an opening.
Hold your own.
Huh? Yes, I think I can get up and think of something to say that would be apropos of what he had just said. But what I'm trying to say is this, that nothing is as good as prepared material. You see, the only reason an ad lib is good is because the audience knows that you have taken advantage of a situation. Then they think that's great. But supposing Bob Hope and I, or Jessel, who's a great ad-lib speaker, or Groucho Marx, they'll all tell you the same things I'm telling you. Exactly. Bob, Will, and Groucho, all better ad-lib comedians than I am. They'll tell you the same things, that we wouldn't dare go anyplace and say, I'm just going to stand up and I'm just going to talk.
Off the top of your head.
Well, you couldn't. A couple of people could do it a little bit, maybe Will Rogers to a certain extent. I've seen Will Rogers do it great, but I've seen him not know how to get out of it. Now, Jimmy Walker, I think, was the greatest.
Heard him make a speech.
Well, he was great, because he could get up and make a serious speech, and he could make a comedy speech. He could blend them both, and he knew just how to handle it. And, of course, he was so glib of tongue. You see, he was well-versed in everything, and on every subject. His vocabulary was great, and Jessel is the same way. But... in fact, Jessel taught me this a little bit about speaking, but I've had to do a lot of it. Always be prepared. Know what you're going to say about everybody. Have your opening remarks prepared, your closing remarks. Have notes made of them, or written, or whatever you want to do. And my thoughts about ad-lib comedy is always know what you're going to say and make it sound like you don't. Then you've hit the right.
It seems so easy to say, the way you say it, but it must be difficult to make it seem impromptu.
No, because, for instance, it depends what style you have in working. Now, when I say, like Bob Hope and I, you saw our show the other night, didn't you? Which sounded very impromptu. Well, we did. We had a few ad-libs, but we waited till one of us started something. Like, for instance, I started something, an ad-lib about saying something about that I just can't look at his nose, I said to the audience. Then he came back, and then I came back, and suddenly, if we wanted to stay there, we perhaps could have kept that up for about a minute or two. But you're worried about time. But then something happened later in the show, I think, and we did it. But we both knew every line of the show. You see? We both knew everything we were going to say. And now you take when people say to me, do you do much ad-libbing on your television show? I said, I do quite a bit. Something may happen, I'll ad-lib. I've done a lot of it. But I prefer to get a big laugh and something
that I've sat down all week working on and paying big money for and trying to figure out myself, and then find out that this is great.
That it works.
That this works. This is an achievement. You know?
I see what you mean.
It's like a fella who, instead of betting on a horse, take a man knows nothing about horses, and he accidentally bets on a horse and the horse comes in a loss. Sure, that's a kick. But a bigger kick is if a fella has the racing form in front of him and he knows about horses.
He
figures it out, and then he picks the right one, then he's got something. And this is exactly the same. Now, we sit down here with my riders right in this room where you're sitting, and we work out routines. And we laugh and we have fun. We think this is great or this isn't. And I say, well, we'll read it and we'll see.
What part of the time does the people laugh the way you laugh? 50% of the time, or has it got to be better than that? I mean, if you and your writers think something funny and sit here laughing, how about the audience? Do they usually laugh at that same thing?
As a rule, and we can be wrong. Maybe it's something that's a little too on the inside, a show, but maybe we're laughing at something that's too much on the inside, because, you know, sometimes a fellow will say something, it'll hit you funny right away. Now, as a rule, you mustn't analyze it, because if it hits you funny right away, you put it in. But sometimes you must analyze a certain kind of a joke, because when you do analyze, you find out, well, now, wait a minute. They may not know enough about this subject, or this not,
well,
you know.
Not to interrupt, but I think Hope has too much stuff about the freeway and about smog, and his stuff is a little too Los Angeles, and I'm a great admirer, too.
Yes, I know you are, Pete, and let me tell you something about that. It isn't quite that bad. It, as a matter of fact, he very seldom says something that you wouldn't know about.
Well,
unless,
I know about it.
So do people. Now, they read about the smog here. They know about freeways. They've got them all over the country.
They don't call them freeways back east.
What do they call them?
They call them the Pennsylvania Turnpike. They call it the Superhighway. But there's no freeway.
Well, there's no freeway. No. But I think gradually they learn what it is. Now, for instance, I've had people say to me, why do you always do so many jokes about Anaheim, Azusa, and Cucamonga?
Well, they're funny words, of course.
Well, not only that, but I give them an answer to that right away. They say, what do... They're towns, don't you? Now, you know that Azusa, Anaheim, and Cucamonga is not New York, Chicago, and Philadelphia. So you've never heard of them, so you know they are. Now, here are the basic things you know. You know those are three towns. Is that right? I said, yes. I said, you know there must be very, very small towns. You've never heard of them. And the way we do the joke, you know there must be near Los Angeles. Now, you've got three towns near any place you want to mention where you live in the East. And all you have to do is figure out, there's nothing to figure out. And then they say, yeah, I guess you're right.
Every time I have three funny names near it.
And it, certainly, it's just that sometimes people are looking for trouble. For instance, I had a thing happen to me in New York recently. Now, this is interesting, I think. I was going to New York because I gave a concert at Carnegie Hall with the symphony on October 2nd.
I read the review.
Yeah, did you? Well, anyway,
very nice reviews.
They were written, of course, by the musical critics, which was nice. Now, what happened was, I thought, now, to have the proper television.
By the
show,
way, was that televised?
No, because I want to do it all over, you see. But anyway, I thought a great radio program would be my preparing.
Radio or television?
My television show was my preparation for the concert.
Well,
in
be.
Carnegie
I
Hall.
Wouldn't
you think it would be great?
Yeah,
so I did it. I had Wallenstein, the great guest conductor, as my guest on the program. I did practicing with the violin, and I did all kinds of things. And it was a very, very funny show. It turned out just great. And got great reviews and everything. But some critic in New York or some said that I spent too much time advertising Carnegie Hall. And when I got to New York, someone says to me, what about this reviewer? And someone said that you spend too much time. So I said, well, that's the silliest thing I've ever heard. Either the show was funny or it wasn't. Now, I'm not advertising a product. I'm advertising there's a benefit concert going on in Carnegie Hall. Now you've got...
Was your show a benefit? I didn't know.
The Carnegie Hall, yes, all my concerts. I said, now here you've got Carnegie Hall, one of the well-known places of entertainment.
Like Madison Square Garden.
That's right. I'm going to give a concert which is ridiculous in itself. It's so incongruous. I've got one of the greatest orchestra leaders, conductors in America, who's going to conduct for me, and I'm going to play with the New York Symphony. Now, do you want anything better than that for subjects and guests for a show?
What was the name of the conductor?
Alfred Wallenstein, who also conducts, I don't know how many times, in Carnegie Hall. Now, the musical world knows him, and even if they didn't, they knew when I introduced him who this man was when he came on my show. Now, I said, also at this party, I said, let me ask you something. Supposing I did an entire half-hour show of going to, what's the name of that small town in North Carolina that has, where they have the American tobacco farms, I forget.
Oh,
but there is a place.
Durham?
Well, there's a place like it. But supposing I went, I spent the whole half hour visiting the farm where Lucky Strike Cigarettes, where they get their tobacco. And the whole half hour was about Lucky Strike Cigarettes. But by going down to this plantation, I had one of the funniest shows I've ever had. Now, what do you care whether it's about Lucky Strike Cigarettes, unless you're merely looking for trouble?
Unless
you don't like me in the first place and you're looking for a chance.
Well, maybe he's president of Chesterfield. He might not.
Well, that's right. Now, there, now you got a point. But to say that I was advertising Carnegie, because in the first place, every comedian tries so hard to get a subject that's different so that the audience will have something new to watch and to hear. That I thought going to Madison Square Garden, I mean going to Carnegie Hall, and I'm going to give a concert would be great subject.
Well, it is.
And it was, and the audience just screamed, and everybody, the reviews nearly every place were wonderful, and I got great comment from it. Now, I got another show by coming back. When I came back, I did a scene where I had a dream. I was nervous, and I fell asleep a little bit before my show. I tried to relax, and I had a terrible dream, and I dreamt that Spike Jonze Orchestra was playing for me instead of them, and I dreamt that George Burns was a devil and came into my dressing room and made me this great violinist, and that Spike Jonze was the director. Now, I got two great shows out of this Carnegie Hall, and they were funny shows. Now, why wouldn't I do that?
Well, I can't see the reason.
I can see no reason either, so this was my answer.
Speaking of George Burns, was it you or Wayne Tisch who said that wonderful thing about Burns was talking about Trendexes and Nielsen's? He said, the fewer times you go on, the better you are. Do you remember that little conversation? And George says, if I'm going to get a couple, instead of putting them on once a week, twice a week, I'm never going to put them on at all, and they're going to have the biggest Trendex anybody
ever. Well, I never heard of it, but that's very funny.
I thought it was at that luncheon where you and Tiss and myself were sitting. Somebody
no,
said it. I thought you said it.
No, no.
Well, according to Tiss, that's what...
No. Truthfully, you know, that's a fallacy, not in every case. I don't know whether fallacy is the right word here, but, you know, in some instances, when you only go on once in a while, it's great. But as a rule, the oftener you go on, the better you are, the better your show is.
Because I believe Groucho's right to go on once a week. I never miss one at Groucho's.
That's right.
I don't think he really agrees with me. He probably thinks he goes on too often.
No, he's on once a week is just great. Now, it's good for me to be on twice a month, once every 2 weeks. But if I go on less than that, it isn't good. Because now, let me put it to you this way. The first year that I was on television, I only did 4 shows. The second year, I did 6 shows. A little bit easier. The third year I did...
Maybe a little easier.
It was a little easier by doing 6 shows.
Really?
Sure, because I was in the groove a little more. I didn't have to think that each one was such a special thing. I was commencing to fall into a groove. Now, the third year was easier because I did 8 shows. Now, the fourth year was easier. I did 1 a month. The fifth year, I did 1 every 3 weeks. The sixth year... No, I started... my third year, I started doing... 4th year I started doing 1 every 3 weeks. Then it became easier. Then finally the last 2-3 years I did 1 every 2 weeks. And this was easier.
That would really fix it.
Say, listen, Pete, by the way.
What?
If you don't need the story.
Yeah.
If you don't need the last line of the story about Bill Silver sending the last wire to me, because I want to do it in a few places. Oh, when is this coming out in the magazine?
Well, it can't be 8 weeks at least, maybe more.
Oh, well, then it's all right. Then it's all right. Then it's all right. But I'm going to do it at my concert here, April. I'm going to do it for my concert here, April.
Takes us 5 weeks to print anyhow, you know, and I have written something. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Well, I want to do it at the concert, and I want Phil to send me that wire again. You know, but I want to read it at my concert here, which is April 20th. I know what it was. I was talking about how much easier it is to
do it once every 2 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah, now it's much easier for me to do it once every 2 weeks, because now I'm in a groove, and I can always keep from, all the shows can't be good, but I can keep from being lousy, let me put it that way, or I think I can. Now, in some cases, it's easier for some people to go on less often, because if they're just doing comedy shows, like the reviews, with no particular characterization like I have with all the different facets, you know, like being stingy and being a coward and having a Maxwell and Rochester and I don't know, all the different things that I'm associated with, makes it a little easier for us to do it oftener, you see, because if we get on a subject, we can always play it off of my character, you see. That's why it's better for me to be on oftener.
It builds, then.
Yes, it builds off. But once a week would be a little more difficult, because, see, once a week, not only would we have to think of ideas all the time, but we would have to accept them, because we haven't got time. Once every 2 weeks, even if there's an idea I don't like.
You can be more selective.
Well, look what I just did for the, I just told you about the Shower of Stars,
yes,
where I didn't like the whole first half, and we just rewrote it in a day, and, practically a day. You see? And I got time to do it.
Your friend Crosby feels very deeply that maybe there are all kinds of reasons that people, you know, they don't want you in your living room very often. Well, of course, Bing hasn't been in people's living rooms very often. Maybe that's the reason.
I don't know. I know that...
All I can say is that I'm awfully glad every night, once a week, Groucho comes on, and I'm always there, and I'm always happy. I never get tired.
That's right. What about I Love Lucy? And Burns and Allen, all high-rating shows, and everything, all up there, and they've been gone every week. I Love Lucy, been number one for years.
Absolutely. And you don't get tired of Mr. Van Doren, although he's probably going to get knocked off, or he hasn't already been. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I don't know how the hell you talk about it, except you seem so articulate and so hip to show business, and after all, you spent a couple of years at it.
Yeah.
But to me, you've always been, and people have told me, including Hope and Crosby, that you're a master of timing. I don't know what exactly timing is. Is it a matter of waiting, have the courage to wait? In Hope's case, I think it's a matter of having enough guts to just stand there and do nothing for a while, you know, and look around like this. Now, is that part of timing, Jack?
Well, timing is a peculiar thing to explain. Now, I will say this. You can learn it, but you can only learn it if you basically have it. By that I mean, if you never have any timing, if you never had it, even at the start, if you never had it. What I'm trying to say, you've got to have it to start with, and then you can only improve on it.
I see.
But if you never had it or have no idea about timing, then... Of course, nearly every comedian times pretty good. I mean, any of the real comedians that they know. Yes, or you wouldn't be, because that's the first thing you have to have is timing. Now, some may have better timing than others, but they have it in their own way. Bob Hope's timing is to keep on talking after a joke and then stop and go back. Mine is to definitely a dead weight after a joke and look at the audience. You see, everybody has a different way of doing it. But timing, I think, is something that you learn without knowing it by being in show business a good many years, if you've had, if as I say, if you had it to start with, and if you love the business so much and your work, you gradually are doing it a little better and a little better and a little better, and you don't know it. Like, for instance, let me say this way. Now, Gracie Allen, I think, Gracie Allen and Judy Holliday have timing that I think is the greatest, and Bea Lilly, too. Grace, I would say I'd pick three girls like that. Now, I'm sure, I don't know about Bea, I think Bea knows what she's doing every minute, and I think Judy does. But Gracie, whose timing is almost, it is perfection. This is the greatest timing in the whole world. Gracie doesn't know that she really has it. She doesn't know that she, no, she knows she has it because she knows what people say and what people are thinking. But she has no idea at all why she has it.
Well, she does.
She has always worked like this. I can go back 30 years when Burns and Lamb were doing Act and Vaudeville, and she had that timing then. Now, she must have improved it some, but as far back as I can remember, the man who had really improved in that time is George. But Gracie's always had it. Gracie's always had it. Now, she couldn't tell you any reason. She couldn't tell you why or how. And the biggest mistake you could ever say to Gracie, I had this happen once. I'll tell you a peculiar thing about timing. George, Burns and Allen and I were on the same bill together in Newark, New Jersey, about 32 years ago. I can remember like it was yesterday. And for about 2-3 years, Gracie's been doing, you know, they've been doing the same routine those days in vaudeville. And she had one joke that I used to love the way she told this joke. Now, this is a true story that I'm telling you. I don't recall the joke, but I recall the incident. And when she came off the stage one day, I said to her, Gracie, I always stand in the entrance when you do that one joke because the timing of that is true. She said, which joke is that? And I told her. The next show, she did the joke very badly. She did it so badly after that George had to take it out of the act, and then says to me, Jack, next time don't be so complimentary, mind your own damn business. It took a long while before they could put it back in again, because the minute she was conscious of what she was doing, it was no good. See, the minute she had to think and say, come to the joke and say, this is the joke Jack likes, then you start to do something with it, you see? So timing is something that you can't think about when you're working. The only time you think timing a joke is if you know that there should be a certain pause here. You see, the pauses are all up to an audience.
Well, it takes a lot of guts to have to pause, doesn't it?
Not if the audience is laughing, because, you see, you only pause while they're laughing. They don't have to scream, but while they're laughing. Now, just before the laugh dies out, you carry on. Or, if you have a feeling that they'll stop and start again, you just stay and look at them. But you better have that, feeling.
You better be sure.
You better be sure, you know. Are there certain jokes that I know that if I just keep looking, they'll start again, you know? Then there's some that you got to go out. Otherwise, you got to catch it just before they stop dead, if you can possibly catch it that way, you know?
How would you describe Goebel's timing? You did fairly good on You and Hope, for example.
Well, I think Goebel has very, very good timing.
I did too, but wasn't how a man.
Well,
man
he has a timing of a fella. Well, he's got, you know, the way he tells jokes, like he wants to say something and then, well, no, this isn't what I wanted to say, and he switches and he does little things and it makes it sound impromptu, you know? Now, I know when I sometimes have to make a lot of speeches at banquets, or let's say I'm a Toastmaster. Now, there's a trick with that sometimes. For instance, generally, when I first get up, I know what I'm going to say, let's say, for the first few minutes. I may be impromptu after that, but for the first few minutes, I know what I'm going to say. But I try a trick of hemming and hawing and fumbling a little bit with a word here and there, and so that the, so it sounds, I know what I'm going to say, Yeah, I know exactly what I'm going to say, but you fumble with it as though you don't know, and you're thinking, and the audience thinks, gee, you must have ad-libbed that. That sounds great, you know. Like, I have a trick sometimes that I do also on a stage where I might have notes of certain jokes I don't want to forget. Or let's say I'm an MC, and I knew in this spot I had a great joke, I don't want to forget it. Now, maybe I will just about forget it. I'd say, now, ladies and gentlemen, I take out my card and I say, I'd like to introduce next, and suddenly I see this joke I forgot. I'd like to introduce next, oh, by the way, I must tell you a funny thing happened to me. And they say, gee, this fellow thinks I didn't at all. I saw it right there, you know. And there are tricks to it, too, you know, because you can't remember everything, you know.
Oh, God, no.
You can't, but if you write it down, there's a tricky way of going into it, you know. You make off your all-through, and then all of a sudden you keep talking and talking. And I did that on my stage show. I don't want to sound like I'm bragging here.
No,
I'm just trying to answer.
I'm trying
to answer questions about at least the way I try to do it, you know. But I think, going back to what we were talking about timing, I think most of the good comedians have good timing. I say there can only be a difference in is one better than somebody else, one not quite as good. Take Ed Wynn, sensational timer. Now, Ed Wynn used to time jokes. Of course, he was the perfect fool, did you know?
Ed Wynn.
Oh. Now, Ed Wynn, to me, during the days of the old musical shows in New York, the days of the Follies, and I would say, I'm one of those who always agree that Jolson was the world's greatest entertainer in everything he did, whether he told jokes or I think he told a joke better than anybody else, sang songs. He was really the world's greatest entertainer. And during the days of his, really in the heyday, his magnetism, I don't think anybody's ever come up to it since then. And Ed Wynn, in the same way, in his style of comedy, which was fool, but the perfect fool fit him, he had a timing that was just wonderful. He had the kind of timing and delivery that made him such a fool, but he was an honest fool. He was sincere. You believed everything he said because he used to laugh and think the funniest thing happened, and would be a thing like he said something about his uncle whose head was knocked off or something, and he was still walking around, and he'd tell you a story about it, and by God, you'd almost believe it. Then maybe 10 minutes later, a fellow would walk across the stage with his head on, and it was, oh, uncle must have just got back from so-and-so, you know?
I was always there to see him do so good in The Great Man.
Yeah. I think he's going to be on one of my showers to start some.
Have you seen The Great Man? I haven't, but they say it to the
No, I didn't see it yet. I'm going to see it right here. Great.
He's from Philadelphia, I think.
Yeah.
Isn't he?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful comedian. Genius. You know, I used to laugh so hard at him, Pete, in the New York shows, that Mary wouldn't go in with me the same night that I went to see him. Most of the time she wouldn't, because I would laugh and it would be almost obvious that I was trying to get attention. You know, Mary says, gee, Jack, sometimes it's embarrassing. I can't help it. Because either I laugh like hell or I don't laugh. You know what I mean? There's nothing very thing in between for me. And God, this man just, I used to scream. And honest, I would get the attention. Wynn always said, geez, he loved it when I was in an audience, you know. Because, and he used to say it from the stage. He said, well, I know Jack's out there. And I didn't do it really for that purpose, believe me, you know. But what are you going to do if a guy strikes you that funny? You laugh, you know. And this is the way he used to just kill me. And imagine 2.5 hours without one risque line. He wouldn't say goddamn on the stage. And sometimes that isn't so bad if you got a terrific punchline, is it, for a musical?
No,
He wouldn't say that. I remember he did a scene once where he was had a fix.
Did they have real standards about this?
Huh? Well, they have certain.
They're sitting here sort of generally kicking the gong around about various comedians and their
take. Everything but me, huh? Does it all fit into the situation?
Sure it does. But
now, I started to say one very interesting thing about when one of the acts he used to do in the review. You ever see those acts where they used to take cloth, yards and yards of cloth, and they would dress and make dresses?
Well, there used to be a man, a fellow who walked around.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Now, Edwin did this, and he'd take a very shapely, beautiful showgirl. Now, you know, when you're pinning yards of lace and silks or satins or whatever it is around a woman's body, you naturally, when pinning it here, you can't always be watch out with your hands what you're doing. So he would dress this girl just like she would be dressed by any little dressmaker, man or woman. And never once in the audience did you ever have a feeling, no matter where his hands were, that this man was ever going to try and get a laugh at that point. You never even laughed. He could have his arms, his hands near her breasts, or any place in her body.
That's sort of a nice tribute to the guy.
Well, it's the greatest thing I've ever seen. I've seen him do it, have his hands right there, or any place in her body, back or anything, and you knew, you didn't even think of it. You knew that he's not going to say or do anything that has to do with that movement. All he is doing is dressing her, and his talk is absolutely away from there entirely. His talk is about, he's just saying, would Catherine Cornell do this that I'm doing right now, you know, and silly things like that. That's it. It is a great tribute, but deservedly so. To stand on the stage 2.5 hours and make people scream
something.
Is something with all clean material. You can't do it hardly in a show today. No, I don't care how clean you are, you gotta have something. He never had one. And she had to be able to dig up this material, you know.
Tell me, how would you describe Sid Caesar's timing? Does he have any special
great time? Great timing. And now Sid Caesar, of course, is one of the real great, if not the greatest, character comedians that we have.
I think Groucho thinks so, too.
Yes, I think he's one of the great, great character comedians. By that, as Sid Caesar once explained to me, when he has to be himself for a moment, he's a nervous wreck. He even said to me, you know, funny thing, Jack, he says, I just can't be Sid Caesar. But the minute I'm somebody else.
Like one of those characters.
As one of those characters, he says, I feel at home and everything is great. And now everybody can't be the same type. Now, when I have to do a character, I'm nervous. When I have to do a character, I don't feel as easily as I feel when I'm just being Jack Benny.
That's a funny thing to say, that I'm nervous when I'm myself, isn't it?
Huh?
It really is a funny thing, but odd.
That's right. He explained that to me, though, that something when he was a kid, there was some reason for this. I don't recall at the moment what it was.
Pretended he was someone else, but he was unhappy.
Whatever it was, but there was some reason for this. I don't recall at the moment what it was.
Pretended he was someone else, but he was unhappy.
Whatever it was, but when the minute he goes in the character, and I don't think there's a better character comedian in the business, and particularly in the television business.
That's pantomime, but he plays the invisible piano.
That's right. Oh, he does it beautifully. And when he does these characters, whether it's a Westerner or anything he does, a German or an Italian. Now, you know, I understand that he does the Italian, German, and everything, and talks, and doesn't speak one word of it, but it sounds like
it. I didn't know that.
No! None of them do in the show. None of them can speak Italian, German, or anything.
But it sounds like
that. That's sure. You could be an Italian, so you'd say, you must be saying something, and I can't say when. Oh, no, he's great. Really great. They're all different types, Jackie Gleason, a great acting comedian, you know.
Jackie was the last one I wanted to ask you about. What is the difference between an acting comedian and a character comedian? I say it sounds the same to me, just being a layman.
Well, the difference is,
Jackie acts in one character. See? He acts, he's practically, he's the big sort of loudmouth character who talks, you know, and who, the usual thing that can happen at home when the honeymooners or the fella fights with the wife and he wants to get the best of her and he's lost, you know, he does that better than anybody. You almost believe he's angry at her, you know, he does that beautifully. And he does, but he can tone, now he can play, he gets terrific, the pathos in his things, he can make the complete switch.
Make people cry?
Oh yeah, he can do both, he can do, he does both beautifully, he can be funny, but at least, but he plays, it's the same voice, and it's one and same character, he's not doing a German, he's not doing an Italian, he's not doing anything, you know. Or if he does it, he'll do it in a hokey way to get laughs to the other extreme, you see? He'll do it purposely to be hokey, you see? But I think he's great.
Because one of the things I like about you is that you don't spend most of your time on psychiatrist couch, at least I don't think you do. I don't know much about you, but you seem like a real normal, natural citizen.
Well, I don't. I would. I think psychiatry is a wonderful thing.
If you had to.
Psychiatry is wonderful, and I think, strangely enough, I think it would be great for most people, maybe including myself once in a while, just to sit down and have a talk. There's something a little bit wrong with everybody, and get a couple of things ironed out. But I haven't been to the point where I have to go or anything like that, you know. But, I don't think it hurts anybody unless nothing in the world bothers them, probably, you know, maybe somebody like that.
Is there somebody like that? I wouldn't know.
I don't know. There must be something bothering everybody.
By the way, as you speak of the comedians, did you see Mickey Rooney in a thing called A Comedian by any chance?
I saw him rehearse a little bit. I didn't see the show, but at rehearsal he was just great. I didn't have a chance to see the show.
Sounded like he, in that role, you'd think he would, he was almost psychopathic.
Yeah. He did it very well, I hear. I'll tell you how well he did it. I came up to rehearsal, he was in the middle of it. And the director called time.
What's that mean?
Well, 5 minutes off. And when they
take five.
When they did, he turned around and all the hell out of everybody in the chorus and all the actors. And I got mad as the devil. I thought, is he showing off in front of me or something? I thought, how dare he talk to me? Then I found out that the director was the director in the play, and this was all part of the play, because a couple of minutes later they went through the same routine again. And I called Mickey Rooney over. I said, Mickey, you must be one of the greatest actors in the world. I was just sore as hell at you. I really, truly thought it. Because I thought the director was really directing the play. That's what it looked like, you know?
That's a great compliment.
Oh, my God. I was mad as hell. I couldn't understand it because it looked, and of course, they just looked at him really like they were also out of the play for a minute. Imagine if I'd ever got up and said something. Jesus, good thing I didn't. Wasn't too fresh there.
Are there people that raise hell with the cast and the directors and the musicians and things and rehearsal about it?
Well, I hear about it.
I hear about it, too.
I hear about it, so I guess there must be some. I don't know. We don't have
I don't that. Want their names anyhow. I just want to
no,
avoid that.
I hear about it, but I don't know. We don't have that kind of confusion on our show. There's no confusion or no troubles or, oh, once in a while there might be an argument, somebody loses his head for about a minute, you have to, but that's about as far as it goes. You see, everybody, when you're well organized, everybody has his own job, but they contribute just the same, but the contribution isn't my running over to see
what's in the camera when I know the cameraman and the director knows? Or my mind isn't directing movements when I know my director knows that better than I do. Any discussions we would have is generally about a piece of business or a joke. Is it good or isn't it? You see? Now, I understand there are some comedians who not only want to be in it, star in it, but they want to look in the camera and they want to direct it. Well, this means to me that they have no faith in their cameraman and director.
You've got an egomaniac. Well,
whatever it is, I don't know. Well, if I didn't have that much faith in them, then I wouldn't want them. And any suggestions I make during a program, I generally sit pretty quiet and let it go on because I think I've done my part when they finish the script. But any suggestions I make are always open for discussion because if everybody agrees with me, or let's say out of our group, a 5 out of 7 agree with me, I think, well, I guess I'm right, let's do it. A 5 out of 7 don't. And I say, I guess I'm wrong, we won't do it. That's about as far as we get.
Sounds like it's sort of a happy show.
It is. It really is. We have a lot of fun. A lot of fun rehearsing. And it's...
Sounds like a very pleasant way to earn
it. It is. And most of the people... Well, it's not easy. By that, I mean, we still have to work all the time. I get tired. I get mentally tired. Preparations and everything, maybe not enough rest. Of course, not enough rest has a lot to do. I'm to blame for this because in the middle of it, I run to New York and give a concert, and I run to Philadelphia and give a concert. This means I run around seeing shows and I go to parties. Well, this isn't anybody's fault but mine.
I read that you wrote with the opening at Dean Martin.
Yeah. You see, all of this is excitement in the middle of your work and everything, but. Nobody held a gun up to me and said, you got to go to Dean Martin's. You know, I did it to myself, you know. But I enjoy it. I have a lot of fun.
But the business, there used to be a discussion of live versus film television. I never hear that anymore. That sort of died down. Apparently, it doesn't make any difference anymore, does it?
Well, no. I think there is a preference, though, to some people's shows. I think my shows, most of my shows, people like me live. Better than film, unless I have an especially good film.
Clear and sharp and well.
No. Yeah, a real funny, real good show. But otherwise, they prefer live because I have, there's more of an intimacy there because I generally open talking to the audience and things like that, which is difficult to do.
Now, there is a feeling. You get the feeling coming through.
That's right.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I think there must be something. It comes through on live. It doesn't quite come through on film.
But if it's good entertainment, you know.
Well, the laughter on live is different from the laughter on film, isn't it?
Well, the laughter on live is right there, and you can time it the way you want it. The laughter in film, you got to leave it open, and then you play it for an audience and use the audience laughter as a cue track.
Oh, I see.
You see where to put in laughs on a film, you see? But you should use... anytime you put a laugh track in a film, when you play it to an audience, you should use very good at judgment. You should be very intelligent in putting laughs. Any laughs into a film. Now, film, television films need laughs because they're generally played in a home to one or two people, three people.
I didn't know that. I thought they were sold used to me.
What?
That they were played in a home to one or two. Oh, I see what
you mean. Oh, I mean, only one or two people. While a movie, there can be 500 to 5,000 watching.
That's right.
You see, you have, the movie has its laugh track by its audience.
That's right.
You see? But we don't, so therefore it's necessary. But I think you have to be very, very careful. I think it should be very delicately done. I think a big laugh, well, you get it from when you play it in front of an audience, the film, you get the idea where it belongs. You might play to only 50 people, and you know where you're
going. Well, you don't just take a laugh track and double men. You really play these things to an audience.
Yes, but if you only play to 50 people, and you get a big laugh, then you want to have the laugh sound as though there are 250 people. But where I say you have to be careful is if a gag or a piece of business just calls for a snicker, just put in a snicker. If it calls for a giggle, put in a giggle. If it calls for an anticipatory that the right word? Anticipatory?
That's a good word.
If it calls for that kind of a laugh, where they're anticipating something and they're sort of giggling, then you must put that in. Now, when you got a sock laugh, you must put a sock laugh in it, you see? Just like it would happen, because I figure this is what would happen if I were doing a live show. Now, with a live show, I don't have to worry.
But you have to be fairly modest and humble about what kind of laughs you're going to get, I suppose, or you go overboard.
Well, yes, a lot of people, I think, do, but I'm very, very careful. I've gone in, I've seen a lot of the dubbing thing, and sometimes they might dub it without me, and I've taken out a lot of big laughs and made them small. I've taken out laughs where they didn't belong at all. Now, I've also said, wait a minute, fellas, this joke is too big. You got to put in a bigger laugh in here. Because this joke, if I was doing this live, and I did this piece of business, they would not only laugh, but they would applaud at the end of it. Because I have that, you know, you have that feel about what would happen right
here. Well, you've been in it long enough to know.
That's right. Now you got to be modest, but you've got to take advantage of where the audience would actually laugh. Then what happens is, then the people watching at home do not notice the laugh track. See, it doesn't
it's
catch
bad
them.
If they do.
Yeah, you see, by that I mean if they notice the audience are laughing loud where they shouldn't be, then they notice that immediately.
Well, that's a good rule of thumb. If they notice the laugh track, then it's bad.
It's bad.